So in this analogy, Wat Van Aert is the king.
Yes.
Laporte is a vassal.
He's a duke.
And
he's
the
a count.
Entire rest of the peloton. He's a duke count. Okay.
Yep.
And the entire rest of the peloton are feudal peasants.
Well, yeah, or maybe we're the peasants. Right? I don't really know who the peasants are, but basically, Wout is the king.
It's us.
And Christophe Laporte is a very powerful nobleman, and you got to keep him happy, or else he might team up with somebody else and try to overthrow you.
Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Wednesday, March 29th. It's my brother's birthday. He doesn't listen to this podcast. He'll never know I gave him a shout out, but got to do it. We got lots to talk about this week. We have the Tour of Flanders coming up this weekend. I am packing to head to Belgium, which I'm pretty excited about. We're going to get into a bit of a Flanders preview later this episode. We're going to talk about genetic doping. We're going to talk about Jumbo-Visma's sponsor problems. We're going to talk about Eddie Merckx being a crotchety old coot. And a little bit of Doors Door Van Vlaanderen and the fact that a couple teams that you wouldn't expect to be good are good. And in fact, I don't know, they've sort of like stolen the soul of Quickstep or something like that. We've got Movistar, we've got FDJ, both having better classic seasons than the classics team. We're going to talk about that as well. Joining me today, welcome back, Kate Wagner. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I love the energy that you always bring to the intros here. Johnny Long, welcome back.
Hello, I'm going to take this opportunity to piggyback on your birthday wish to wish my dad a happy birthday in 2 days, seeing as I won't be there because we'll be in Belgium. And I think he listens. He definitely reads, but maybe listens.
Mm. My brother, I think he just clicks play to give us the download, but doesn't actually listen to any of it. I'm pretty sure that's what he does. Also joining me, Dane Cash. Welcome back to Placeholders.
Hi, Kaylee. Thanks.
It's good to have you back. We've kind of missed you, but you've been busy with something that's pretty serious.
It's very serious, but it's good to be a little less serious every once in a while.
Slightly less serious. Before we get into today's show, quick reminder: this podcast, all of our podcasts, this Geek Warning, Wheel Talk, Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast, these are all supported entirely by members. That means if you're not a member and you're listening, you are a freeloader. I don't mean to guilt trip you too hard, but that's just the reality. So head on over to escapecollective.cc and sign up if you haven't already. We're trying something new from the media business perspective, and so far it's going great, but we're a long way from, well, comfort. I'll put it that way. We're a long way from profitable, to be perfectly honest. And so if you haven't already, please go sign up and make sure that we can continue doing this and that you can continue listening to this podcast and all the rest of our podcasts. Thank you. All right, let's get into this. There's been a bunch of sort of, I don't know, classics stories over the last couple weeks, often involving crotchety old Belgians and their opinions on the way that things should be going. So this is where we're going to start, because I think it's a fun story. So, well, I've talked enough. I'm going to throw it over to Dane and say,
I'm sipping on my coffee over here. I'm just trying to enjoy my morning, and then I gotta get thrown to. What is this?
No, I changed my mind. I'm going to Kate. Kate, can you give us the rundown of what's happened here?
Thanks.
Okay, so basically everyone in Belgium was mad that Wout Van Aert gave the win in Gent-Wevelgem to Christophe Laporte. Eddie Merckx was mad. Tom Bonin was mad. One guy who wasn't mad was Fabian Cancellara, who thought it was nice, which checks out with Tom Bonin being mad. Yep. So that is honestly the TLDR of that. I just want to say that personally, I think it's cool that Eddie Merckx is still alive in the first place. He's pretty old. And I honestly think that if I were Eddie Merckx, I would believe that I had earned every right to be a huge crank. So whenever people are like, oh, Eddie's at it again, it's like, yeah, he's got a right to be. He's like the winningest bike racer ever. Sorry. If anyone's got a right to be a crank, it's probably Eddie Merckx.
I've got a number of points now that I'm done sipping my coffee. First of all, you just used the word winningest. And on the Pretty Serious Bike Racing podcast last week, Kit Nicholson refused to say that word. And I'm glad to be in a place where there are enough Americans that that word is going to be used. Also, Eddie Merckx is an older fellow. I can't wait to be so old that people express surprise that I'm still alive on podcasts. And lastly, Bonin is not that old. I don't think
No.
Can he be that crotchety? Like, it seems like he's really in a crotchety place these days, just trashing bike brands and other pros. I don't know what that's all about.
Do you think he's
Bonin is 42 years old, by the way.
Do you think he's getting ready to step into the Eddie Merckx shoes of being the go-to crank? Like, I imagine it's like, you know how in the Cold War, the like Russian and American president had like a telephone that directly linked the two of them? I think that's what like Het Nieuwsblad and Eddie Merckx currently have. And then whenever Eddie Merckx, you know, passes on to the next life, that phone just gets like taken like a couple streets down wherever else in Belgium to Tom Boonen's house. And then he can just give the hot take ever after every race.
I think that's a reasonable assumption. It is. The Bonin thing is interesting to me because he has historically, I don't know, kind of pushed back on the Belgian tendency to like proclaim next Eddie Merckx's and things like that. Like he actually points at that as an issue in his early career. You know, I don't know how many of our listeners were paying super close attention to bike racing in sort of the early Tom Bonin years, but Tom Bonin had some interesting years. He had some cocaine positives and some other exciting things, and he definitely points at the fact that basically when he just sort of kicked off, I think it was Roger de Vlaeminck who was basically like, okay, you are the next great Belgian. And he's sort of refused to do that as a result, and in general has kind of stayed away from providing his own sort of personal opinion and input on the actions of the Belgians that have come after him. And so this is actually kind of a bit of a new direction for Tom Bonin, and the fact that he's kind of willing to weigh in on what Wout van Aert should not be doing. I kind of like it. Because I agree with Kate, and I think that crotchety old bike racers is part of the tapestry of life and is a very important thing for our sport, even if I think that they're completely insane in thinking that that gifting your super domestique a win in a race that you've already won is a bad thing. I still think that having them around and having them spouting these insane opinions is generally more fun than not.
Yeah, I to actually get to the meat of the argument. It's not really an argument, but a conversation. Yes, I agree. Having the crotchety old folks around, particularly their Belgian, is an important. It's just part of this. But I think also part of this whole bike racing thing is the dynamics of gifting is a strong word, but working together and then having one person take the win as maybe a part of a. Not necessarily even a spoken deal. The money doesn't have to change hands. It's just that's sort of how it works in bike racing. You make these sort of deals on the road, and it's an important part of bike racing. And I think we should make a special distinction here. These are two teammates. It's not like these are two riders on rival teams who are making some kind of agreement that, you know, is anti-competitive. They ride for the same team. And that, I think, is a huge distinction. I'm completely okay with them doing this as teammates.
I think it's nice.
It's also so fun watching everyone just get triggered into oblivion, depending on which side they agree with. Like this specific conversation like comes up maybe every half a year, and yet every time everyone is just mashing their keyboards, just being like, "Rah!" Like it's amazing. It's so good. It's so good.
Gino Mader. Well,
and then we spend 10 or 15 minutes talking about it.
Yeah, the Gino Mader Roglic thing. Yeah. Matt, that wasn't even a Belgian thing. That was just like...
That went on forever. I mean, Jesus.
I think in general, the official position of the Placeholder Podcast is that gifts are nice to both receive and give. And that, in, you know, I think that that's a fine... Do you all agree? Is that our position? That
I'm okay with them. In general? As long as, you know, money doesn't change hands and...
Well, that's not a gift then. That's a bribe.
I think about 15% of me would like to see teammates sprint for the win.
I would like that.
And the 85% of me realizes, like, okay, that is too dumb. But 15%, I would be like, yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, then you end up with the Volor and Kopecky at Strada Bianca situation. Right?
I think the distinction there is that they hadn't had a conversation and one rider maybe wasn't prepared for that to happen. I think what should happen is if you have a situation where two riders are so clearly going to win the race and they have time to talk about it, which wasn't necessarily the case when they're both grinding up the climb into Siena as they were in Strada Bianca. But when you have plenty of time, if you're joyriding off the front because every other team is so much worse than you, then you should talk about it. And that's cool. You can say, hey, let's sprint for the win. And I kind of want to see Laporte versus Wout van Aert because they're both fast riders. I think that could be a fun sprint.
Also, I guess it's a question of how big the win is. So if that situation happens at the Tour of Flanders, do you see Wout van Aert patting him on the back, being like, go on, Christophe, you got this one. Absolutely. No way.
Absolutely no.
I think even if Wout van Aert hadn't won that race before, if he hadn't won against Wevelgem before, then I think that he would not have done that. He would have just dropped Laporte the last time up the Kemmelberg and been like, peace, I'm going to go do this by myself now. Because he did most of the pulling. He was dropping Laporte left, right, and center. I mean, it wasn't... The thing is, like, that gift didn't come in the final 800 meters. That gift started when Wout waited for him at the go over the Kemmelberg, like, 20 minutes prior. So it was in the works for quite some time and not, like, a last-minute decision.
I think it's also sort of part of the tapestry of bike racing. I really like that, the tapestry imagery that you've conjured up there, Kaylee. This notion of, and again, this is all sort of part of the politics, of you do good things for your teammates so that eventually they'll do nice things for you. And Wout van Aert has a really strong team at Jumbo-Visma. I mean, they are the team of the classics on the men's side for sure right now. And I think if you have that many strong riders on your team, you need to keep them happy. You need to make sure that they're going to be happy to work for you and happy to stay at that team, continuing to work for you. And I mean, this is the sort of thing that you do. You say, hey, you can win this race, and I'll go win that race. That's 101 how teams work. That's how feudalism worked. You know, like that's a very old model. All right, like you do nice things for people who work for you. They'll continue working for you instead of rebelling against you. This has gone back a long time.
Wait. What nice things were feudal lords doing for?
Oh no. This is not the nice things.
Feudal peasants.
No. This is not nice things feudal lords do for feudal peasants. This is kings giving their vassals a ton of land so that their lords will
not everybody like you can eat gruel
shit on the peasants. No. You don't do nice things for them.
So in this analogy, Wout van Aert is the king.
Yes.
Laporte is a vassal.
He's a duke.
And
he's a
count.
And
the entire rest of the peloton. He's a duke count. Okay.
Yep.
And the entire rest of the peloton are feudal peasants.
Well, yeah, or maybe we're the peasants. Right? I don't really know who the peasants are. But basically, Wout is the king.
It's us.
And Christophe Laporte is a very powerful nobleman. And you got to keep him happy or else he might team up with somebody else and try to overthrow you. And that's 101 politics, team making, whatever. That's an old model.
It's just Machiavellian.
Works.
My two-year-old daughter brought home the Prince, Machiavelli Prince, from the library the other day. She picked it up off. Yeah, right. Can't read, thankfully, but that's going to be an interesting one. Anyway, I want to really briefly. We don't want to dive into the tactics of Gent-Wevelgem because that we have another podcast for that now. But I would just like to mention the fact that both races that day were a very good reminder that when it's really yucky outside, going alone is an exceptionally good tactic, right? We had basically two winners, both the men's race and the women's race, where The men's race was more of an attack than in the women's race, where Marlon Ruzer literally just sort of like rode away and everyone was like, nah, we won't chase one of the best time trials in the world. That seems fine. The men's race, there was that, you know, sort of epic attack up the Kemmelberg. But still, like a very poor, disorganized chase effort and solo victories in both races by a large margin. And I think a lot of that came down to just when it's really gross outside, when it's like 3 degrees Celsius and raining, riding by yourself is actually nicer than riding in a peloton in a lot of ways. And I think we saw that over the weekend. So the reason I mention it is because I'm doing a little foreshadowing here. When we talk about Flanders later, it does look like there's the potential for some nasty weather over the next week and a half, both for Flanders and for Roubaix.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm not trusting the forecast just yet, but worth keeping in mind as we start thinking about Flanders and who might win Flanders and how it might be won, that if it is similarly gross, I could see something happening quite similar again. But we'll get to that at the end of the show. Next on today's docket, I want to talk about Movistar. And I want to talk about Movistar in March, which is not something we generally do here on this podcast or ever. They're basically anonymous at Catalunya, which is odd. Although maybe not that odd, considering it's the first sort of post-Valverde year for them. And then this morning in Dwarsdorflander on Wednesday here, we had second place from a Movistar rider. Dane, you as our sort of Spanish correspondent and our chief Movistar correspondent, can you explain who the hell was at the front of this bike race for Movistar this morning and what do I need to know about this person?
Yes, this person is Oyer Lazcano. He would say Lazcano. Although he's Basque, so I don't want to, I don't speak with authority on the Basque language, and his name is pretty Basque. But yeah, Oyer Lazcano is merely 23 years old, and he certainly is not out of nowhere. He was second at the Spanish National Championships time trial last year. He won a stage in Tour de Wallonie, but I was very surprised to see him up there, and he managed to not only finish second in this race, but he did it in a very impressive way. He was in the breakaway. He was in a breakaway. I mean, first of all, the classics are amazing because you can't really talk about the breakaway. There's breakaways all the time. He was in a breakaway for much of the day. He still was able to stay up there and finish second in this race. And this is not the first or even the second time that Movistar has landed a rider inside the top 10 in a classic in the past few days, which is amazing. I mean, I think it's really, really fun to see Movistar up there because they have been the laughing stock of the classics. They have been a go-to for the argument of why does every World Tour team have to go to every World Tour race? You just point to Movistar. I mean, clearly they don't care about the classics, right? Well, apparently they do, or at least Oyer Lazcano does, and his big engine. And maybe we'll see more from him in the future. Maybe it's just that Dwars didn't have quite the same level of big names up there. I don't know, but he looked great today at Dwarsdorflanderen, and yeah, again, good time trial. So maybe not that surprising that he has the engine to thrive in a race like this.
I know one thing about Lazcano, and it was tweeted by Matteo Jorgensen soon afterwards, and it is a picture of Lazcano eating a giant steak with his hands, and he's eating it right up to the bone. It's a fantastic picture.
It's a superb picture.
It's great.
So the reason I want to bring this up, he's the starting point for a broader discussion about the fact that Movistar this year has a better classics team than Quickstep. And that is very, well, it's unusual, as you would point out, Dane. There's a stat chucked around on GCN during the broadcast today that I think previously the best ever result for Movistar at Dwars was like 13th or 11th or something like that for Valverde years and years and years and years ago. This is a team that, as you say, has basically ignored these races for decades at this point. And all of a sudden we turn around and not only do we have Lazcano, we have Matteo Jorgensen doing exceptionally well. He was, if I'll remind you, he was fourth at E3. That's a pretty solid go of it. And they were also in fifth with Ivan Cortina. So what's going on with Movistar? I mean, is this like a concerted shift toward one-day races because they've lost Valverde? Is it just that they happen to have discovered this group of riders in their ranks that they weren't paying any attention to before? What's going on?
I kind of feel like it's more the latter, a matter of discovery of what they had. Yes, these are younger riders who are kind of coming up, but it's not as if they went out and made a huge push to get some of the biggest names, the biggest prospects in classics racing, because that's really not what these riders are. Ivan Garcia Cortina, yes, a little bit, but I don't know that beyond him they've made that much of an effort to go get the big prospects out there, and yet they've managed to kind of put it all together. I think it helps that it's multiple riders, so they're able to kind of fly a little bit under the radar with multiple different guys. But I think the other thing is that they have these riders with big engines, and that can count for a lot when the weather's bad. And when we've talked about this a little bit on a couple of different podcasts, where I think there's attacking racing seems to be really having a moment. I feel like it's hard to control the peloton right now for whatever reason. And if that's the case, having these riders who can attack or get into attacks is really helpful.
We have mentioned the why before, and this is more of a when we get Ronan back on the podcast, but just to remind everybody, the going theory at the moment internally here, and Ronan wrote a piece about this at the old place, is basically that speeds are higher because everybody's way more aerodynamic, and so I'm going to get some of this math wrong probably, but basically the amount of power required to overcome aerodynamic drag is a cubic thing, not a linear thing. And so the faster you go, if you go from the difference between 45 and 46 kilometers an hour is not anywhere near as big as 55 to 56. And so as they get faster and faster and faster, the amount of extra watts required for the peloton to chase down a breakaway that can go even, a kilometer an hour or 2 kilometers an hour faster than it used to be able to go because it's more aerodynamic than it used to be, and they have stupid narrow handlebars and their hoods are turned in, that makes basically the increase in wattage required by the peloton to chase that back is then significantly higher, and that's the theory that we're going with at the moment, because there's no question that there's more breakaways succeeding, not just in the classics, than in any time since I've been watching bike racing, and that stretches back to the the late 90s. It'd be interesting to get somebody who's been watching bike racing longer than I have on this podcast, get Rupert Guinness or somebody back on. I was just chatting with Rupert the other day about getting him back involved in Escape, and ask him whether there was a time previously where this was the case and what that might have been caused by. I think previously it likely would have been caused by something more nefarious, and these days I think that the aerodynamic shifts, the aerodynamic improvement theory, actually it holds a fair amount of water.
Maybe just talk about the effect that has on the racing with, for instance, with Movistar. You don't necessarily need to have a rider who has a really strong sprint to finish inside of a top 10. And at the same time, another impact on racing is that you see riders with really strong sprints, i.e. Wout van Aert, Mathieu van der Poel, attacking anyway. I think there was a time not that long ago where you would see somebody, a sprinter of Wout van Aert's caliber, might say, well, I don't really need to attack, I could just wait. And yet he does it. He'll still, or he'll at least join attacks of others. He doesn't wait for bunch sprints. They go clear, they go far, and yeah, then he still has a sprint to maybe win a 4 or 5 rider sprint at the end. But you just see way more often these riders going on the attack, and unfortunately that the riders, well, unfortunately for them, the riders who don't have that ability get left by the wayside. We just haven't seen a lot of sprinter types winning big classics the way that we did not that long ago when Milan-San Remo was a sprinter's race, for instance.
And Gent-Wevelgem often was. I mean, that's the one I was going to bring up. Is granted, there was the weather probably had an outsized impact on the racing over the weekend. But this is a race that was won by Peter Sagan in his sort of sprinting prime a fair number of times. Won by John Degenkolb. Riders with a strong kick and often out of a decent sized group, and that we haven't seen that in a couple of years now. So. Interesting shifts. And it does, whenever you end up with bike racing decided amongst a much, much smaller group of riders, you kind of, you open up that opportunity for what we're seeing for Movistar, which is if you can get a rider in that group, you all of a sudden have a chance, if not to win, then at least to pop yourself into the top five in races that the team has never been in before.
Yeah, you're punching above your weight.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Patrick Lefevre and Quickstep are nowhere. And this is really interesting to me. And I don't know why, but I can't imagine Lefevre is particularly excited about the spring.
Okay, he's
far.
An old guy who's a bad crank.
not approved crankiness, Kate?
No, because he's really sexist and I'm a woman and I don't like that.
So misogynistic crankitude is not appreciated amongst the elder Belgians. Yeah, I agree. Dane just gave us a thumbs down.
I didn't give you a thumbs down. See that, Dane. I gave misogyny.
No, yeah.
I'm also adding a thumbs down.
Everyone is giving misogyny a thumbs down on the podcast right now.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you for supporting me. Yeah. Okay, so what about... So where were they in Dwarsdwars van Vlaanderen today? Nowhere. Where were they in Gent Wevelgem? Nowhere. Where are they going to be on Sunday? Who knows? But it's looking like nowhere.
I mean, like Kasper Asgreen is sort of their last remaining guy, and he's had some injuries and some other issues and things like that. But he appears to be kind of like mostly back now.
Yeah, Alaphilippe was also attacking today in Dwarsdorf Wendland. So yeah, I really can't say that word.
They did some pulling at Gent Wevelgem, and they were at the front a bit. But they just weren't at the front in the actual key moments.
We talked about this a little bit on Pretty Serious. How I think it really comes down to Asgreen, because he's supposed to be their big card to play. And you've seen with other teams that have a lot of depth, you still need that big card to play. And that's, I think, been a really important part of what Jumbo-Visma was doing. Is yes, they have all of these options, but at the end of the day, they still have Wout van Aert as well at the very biggest races. I mean, Dwars is not as big of a race. With Quickstep,
yeah,
I think they really need that one big guy to really function. And Asgreen, for whatever reason, despite being a monument winner, is just not on point. Yeah, he had some issues last year, health stuff. But yeah, it's been a fair enough amount of time that you would think he'd be back. He's not, and they really don't have anybody else, apparently, who has been able to step up in the classics.
Yeah, Alaphilippe used to be that guy too. I mean, and again, like a rider, Alaphilippe had such an abysmal season last year that everyone just forgot he existed. And now it seems like he's really trying to get back to where he was. He makes attacks or he shows himself and he becomes visible in the race, but he never quite gets back to that level for whatever reason. I think that's kind of the mystery of like what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who was a like legit Flanders contender for a couple of years there, and we'll get to the Flanders preview later, but I can't imagine we're going to put him in a 4-star, 3-star, 2-star, maybe even 1-star bracket for this weekend. It just doesn't appear to be on the cards for Quickstep this year. And you know, as much as Patrick Lefevre annoys the crap out of us and is like clearly not an amazing human being, it's kind of a bummer when that team isn't doing well, right? Like they add a certain dynamism to the classic season, and without them, I mean, just like imagine if Quickstep was firing on all cylinders and Jumbo was firing on all cylinders and how fun that would be. So I do think that there's something lost when this team's not riding well, and they'll come back. Lefevre, for all of his faults, is very good at building a bike racing team. There's no question about that, and they'll be back. It's just it's a bit of a weird season for them. Speaking of Jumbo,
really quick 5-second note. Like, they have built a decent team over there that has a world champion and a Grand Tour contender. That's just and also sprinters. It's just the classics where there are big question marks now. Anyway,
yeah, but that's a team that like that's their thing.
That's their thing. That's their
this
thing.
This is like Movistar. This is like Movistar sucking at Catalonia. It's like equally weird, right?
Yes.
They've been at the front of these races for so long. It's a strange thing to have to kind of wrap our heads around, and I do think it will I think these are departures from the norm, and we'll probably end up back where we started in a couple of years, right? I think Movistar will find some young Spanish climbing talent, and we'll be back to where they need to be sometime in the next half decade. Quickstep, same thing, right? But the sort of departure from the norm it's an interesting thing to watch play out. I do want to talk about Jumbo-Visma, and specifically about Yumbo. Johnny, you turned around a little story yesterday. This came out of the Dutch press. I think it was
AD
Zonneveld that put this out.
Yeah.
So anyway, fill me in. So basically, Yumbo as a company is potentially not going to be sponsoring sports much longer, which is a big deal.
So this starts last year when Fritz van Aerd, who is the son of the sort of founder of Yumbo, Karel van Aerd, he is arrested on suspicion of money laundering. There's hundreds of thousands of euros found at his house. And it's all sort of tied up in money laundering through motorsport facilities and businesses. And I think there's a guy called Theo E., who's like the other main suspect but hasn't been named. And he's like, and the Dutch newspapers are always writing about Theo E. as this mysterious character, which is kind of not the right name for a mysterious like villain in a story. But anyway, so when that happens, when he gets arrested and they find all the money, he steps down as CEO of Yumbo. And it's announced that Yumbo is going to stop sponsoring a lot of the motorsport connections, with the exception of Max Verstappen in Formula One, because he's world champion, and I don't know when Dutch had Formula One world champions. But in December, Karel van Aerd passes away at the age of 84, and he was the guy who sort of started all of the sports promotion thing with the ice skating team, cycling team, cars. And after that, this year, the news has come out that Yumbo are considering pulling back on all of their sporting investments. The rumored reason is that internally Yumbo have spoken about how they've sort of gained all they can from the promotion. You know, Jumbo Visma have been huge. Like, last year was their biggest year, and like everyone, and they've been sponsoring the team for 8 years now. So everyone who's possibly heard of Jumbo Visma has then gone to a Jumbo Visma supermarket, and there's only so much that your additional ad spend will reap you. The deal currently but the other thing is that obviously if Karel van Aerd was pushing all this and now he's no longer with us or has any sort of hold over the company, then maybe it doesn't happen anymore. The deal with Jumbo Visma is until the end of 2024, I'm pretty sure. So there's still time for like another sponsor to be found or for it to be smoothed over, and for Jumbo Visma to be like, look, we can just get Primoz Roglic to talk about how much he loves Jumbo supermarkets like he talked about the Mortons.
That'll work.
So yeah, that could work.
That's a great plan.
I think it's the time I'll tell of like big cycling team potentially losing a sponsor, but I think it's off the back of Jumbo Visma finally getting everything to click with the sporting side of it, and then suddenly for things to be like, oh, maybe you're going to lose a bunch of money and have to find and go back to being sponsored by mobile phone cases or whatever Belkin made. I don't know.
This is, you know, another version of the classic cycling story where, you know, one of the most successful teams in the world potentially in a sponsor scrap, and we'll see where they find something. I mean, recall that Quickstep was in this place not that long ago, right after one of their phenomenal seasons recently, they almost, I wouldn't say collapsed, but they were in desperate need of some sponsor cash, and there's just no guarantees in pro cycling, which is part of the problem.
Also, it's a shame because they are Jumbo, or like one of the like sort of a pure sponsor. Like, they're just a supermarket. I mean, maybe I don't think I've been to many Jumbo supermarkets. Maybe I don't know what they sell, but I'm pretty confident in saying that they're one of the sort of more morally pure sponsors that you don't feel bad about at all, or it's hard to feel bad about. So I think it's a shame to lose those ones. I like having.
You haven't heard about the Jumbo human rights record? I mean, that supermarket. Yeah.
Selling body parts in the freezer section. Yeah. Yeah, but I like having, like, you know, things that like companies that make gravel or like window putty sponsoring the sport is much better.
Quick note on that team sponsor situation. I really hope that they continue to have the sponsor. I should say though, that should they have a period where they need to not have a sponsor and continue riding while they're still looking, the old Team Blanco kit is my favorite kit that has ever existed.
Oh my God.
So I do kind of like their look, or at least the things they've done in the past when they've been looking for a sponsor. So
when they were, what was it, Belkin? When I bought my Bianchi, the store still had that banner up from like the and this is like one of the only paraphernalia like I've ever seen from that period of Jumbo Visma. And it just like struck me as like extremely strange that they would have, of all things, like this particular, because they were the only Bianchi retailer in Chicago, like a licensed one. It almost does recall like their Rabobank collapse, and that like they had this one sponsor for like a million years, and then, you know, but for very different reasons, obviously, that sponsor left them, and then they had to do the little song and dance, and then they were Jumbo Lotto and El Jumbo, and then they were Jumbo Visma, and then, you know, whatever. It's sort of how it goes. But yeah, it's very interesting to me. I mean, the actual like criminal intrigue is also interesting. Like, what were these Dutch supermarket moguls doing? It's like, you can't it's like, sounds like some Monopoly Man story, like some guy in a top hat hiding cash under his bed. It's like,
yeah,
it's really catchy.
I mean, it was literally that, right? It was like, well, allegedly it was bags of cash, like
this
in
is
a
19th century
a
ass crime.
I mean, you know, you like this guy was the son of a massive
grocery legend, yeah.
Grocery, like, I can't imagine he was like hurting for cash that much. I mean, you would. It's a very strange. It's a very strange thing. Greed does odd things to people. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
I was gonna say I remembered off the back of talking about sponsor. What's going on with them? There, I think it was Jeremy Whittle was reporting that there's also murmurs over at Ineos, because Jim Ratcliffe is currently trying to buy Man United, and he's also trying to outbid the Saudi Arabia, which I think is pretty tough. They have infinite money, and he also doesn't like losing. Apparently, like, he's very upset with there's a British sailor he like put loads of money into to win the America's Cup, and he didn't do very well. So apparently the rumor is that he's getting a bit tired of putting all his money into third place at the Tour and Paris-Roubaix win, to be fair, but.
Well, and everything that he has put money into recently has done worse than it did before. So like, I think we've talked about this on this podcast.
Probably.
A British colleague who will remain unnamed mentioned this, I think, to you and I, Johnny, at lunch at a press buffet at the Tour de France last year, had pointed out that basically everything that Jim Ratcliffe touches turns to shit. We shouldn't say that the current Ineos cycling team is shit. They are not. They are not at the heights. I actually find them quite likable, actually. They're way more likable, but from a results perspective, they are significantly off their prime, right? In particular at the Tour de France, which is really the only thing that matters. But also, like, Ineos is a primary sponsor of the Mercedes F1 team, which went from winning, what was it, like seven championships in a row to having a car that porpoises and comes in seventh. And then he also bought the Nice football team, and they are not great and are worse than they were before, and now trying to buy Manchester United.
So we can only hope then that he succeeds at buying Manchester.
Dang, the Liverpool fan.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, a chemical magnate versus the Saudis is like, I don't know. That's kind of just like having a mosquito fighting another bug that sucks.
If it's not a chemical plant,
but you know what I mean. It's like, let them fight. I have to say that this is the funniest rich person curse you could possibly have. Like, you know, like, you don't have like some picture of Dorian Gray kind of thing going on, or something that like calls into like question, like Dickensian style, your existential, you know, position in society that is like inherently like evil and parasitic as an extremely wealthy person. But no, you sink all your money into sports teams and they lose. That's a hysterical curse, because you know it hurts. But it's also like relatively harmless and kind of funny.
And the guy runs a company that while it produces very important things for sort of modern society, is probably not on the forefront of helping our Earth survive much longer into the future. So
yeah, look at the car.
Yeah.
Oh, the car. And
jeez. And the INEOS Grenadier, the actual vehicle, is just a blatant Defender ripoff that doesn't appear to ever actually maybe exist. Well, the last time we said that on the podcast, we got a sad phone call from like the Australian importer. So apparently, there's at least an Australian importer.
Have you seen the button on that car where it has it's like a beeper for bikes? It's like got a bike logo, and then there's like a red beeper.
Oh yeah,
which is just nuts.
Well, so, there's a fair amount of like kind of debate around this. All right, tangent time. This is the placeholder podcast. We can do this. So, as somebody who has spent thousands of hours riding around on a road bike and has been beeped at a fair number of times, it's basically impossible for me to take that beep as a positive, right? Like, it always scares the crap out of you every single time, even if it's intended to be like a hey. Like, I've literally had friends drive up next to me and be like beep beep, like hey, and it scares the living shit out of me, and I almost fall off my bicycle, and it's terrible. So this little button on the Grenadier, that's the intention, right? Is that it's like a micro beep to basically, instead of being the actual horn, honk honk, it's just like a toot toot, and it's supposed to, like, I don't know, inform a cyclist that you are there. But it's a bit of it's a bit like victim blamey, I guess. I mean, if I'm riding along on the road and an INEOS Grenadier comes up behind me and toot toots me, like, I don't really care that it toot toots me. I would rather it just not hit me. That's really the thing that I'm mostly concerned about. And I it's a weird thing to come from somebody who, or a car company that is in theory like cyclist conscious, because I think it's a bit backwards. Don't you guys think?
The people who also, as someone who lives in the market, or I imagine this is being aimed at, the people who will be buying and driving that car are never going to be beeping at you in a friendly way, a friendly manner.
Do you guys have share the road signs in the UK? Like, it's a yellow, I hear this like a yellow sign says share the road. It's a picture of a bike on it, right?
No, the most common sort of cyclist sign you have is on the back of lorries saying, if you come up beside me, I can't see you, so you might get squashed and it's your fault. We don't really have share the road. Mm. It's not really.
We have the same okay. Lorry truck things. But so the share the road thing, I think, is similar in like sort of boiled down essence to the Grenadier toot toot button, which is like, whenever you ask a non-cyclist what this sign means, they think it means cyclists need to share the road with cars and get out of the way. We think, and like, you know, the Department of Transportation is like, no, there are cyclists around, share the road with them. But it goes exactly the opposite direction, and car drivers just think that it means that we're supposed to share with them and get out of the way of their driving, right? Exactly.
I live in a real cycling country now, and they have signs that just have little bikes on them.
Yeah, that's nice. All we need. That's all we need. I want a sign that just has a picture of a bike on it. Same yellow sign, picture of a bike sign. It just says, don't run them over. I think that would be more effective than a share the road sign, which, to be honest, is quite easily misconstrued, misunderstood.
Yeah, they'll say, like, caution cyclists, but in Slovenian.
All right. While we're on tangent mode, before we get into our Flanders preview here, Kate, I need an update on your jacket. Now, for anybody who doesn't know what I'm talking about, if you kept listening all the way to the end of last week's episode, beyond the music, you got a special bit on Kate's new jacket. Since then, a little bit more reporting has been done. I remain convinced that this is Marco Pantani's jacket. I don't think that is actually the case. Kate, do you have any additional information for us on
this? It's entirely possible that, and someone mentioned this on the Discord server, and I looked a little bit more in depth at it, and it is entirely possible that it belonged to one of the two Slovenian riders that were riding for Carrera in the 90s. That was Jure Pavlič, who actually, I believe, won the Inner Giro jersey, and I think 1989. And then Primož Čerin, who also was in Carrera. And both of them are around still. And they are both still in cycling. I believe both of them can be found hanging around Cade Rog, which is where Pogačar, you know, came up in the ranks. And so I'm going to, you know, go over and ask them about whether, you know, that's their jacket. Because I know enough Slovenian now to ask about a jacket. I've gotten to that point in my lessons. And so stay tuned for this update, because it's very possible that it did belong to one of them. And maybe they would like it back for sentimental reasons, which would be a nice ending.
I think it was either owned by Marco Pantani or Claudio Chiappucci. That's my, I'm going with that.
So I get that EPO boost. Some early 90s doper. If I wear it, right?
Yeah. The EPO actually seeps from the plasticky material into your skin, and you get a hematocrit bump of 8 to 10 points.
That's amazing, because I really need that for going up those little hills, which I found out actually there's a Slovenian word that just means like little kind of bitchy hill that you have to get up to go to work. And it's husar.
What is this word?
Husar. It means the same word for speed bump, but it's a slang word for like the little hill you have to climb to get to work.
I have one of those. It's not to get to work, it's to drop my daughter off in the morning, but it sucks. It's terrible. So I'm going
to
start using
they're like really short, steep little hills to get onto like some street that is like a level above you or something like that.
That's a good word.
You know, like you're down on one street and then there's that hill that goes up to like another street and you have to get up that hill, but it's just this short, steep pain in the ass.
I'm picturing like a block of San Francisco or something like that, you know?
Yeah, shorter.
It's like one street away, but it's way the hell up there.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We're going to add that to the lingo here.
Husar.
It is time to get into our Tour of Flanders preview here. Now, that's why we have you on, Dane, because you are a preview man. So I'm going to let you kind of take it away here. What's going on with the Tour of Flanders? It's coming up this weekend.
It's coming up this weekend. I'll do a quick plug before I get into the preview, and that is that if you want more preview, go to the website, escapecollective.cc, and there will be previews for you to read with all kinds of information about the bike race. It's going to go deeper and in different directions. I'm going to have a little section in which I explain the difference between a duvel and a duple, also a triple and a quadruple. I was going to be drinking one while we did the preview, but it's 10 o'clock in the morning, and I thought that would be a bad look. So, more on the website.
No judgment,
but we've got the Tour of Flanders coming up this weekend, and I mean, it's my favorite race of the year, so I'm pretty excited about it. We're going from Bruges to Oudenaarde again this year after a bunch of years in Antwerp.
Way better.
Bruges is a pretty amazing place. If you ever have a chance to go, I mean, I'm speaking to the choir here on the podcast, but to the listeners, if you ever have a chance to go, Bruges is an amazing city and a really cool place to start a bike race. It's beautiful. It's just got all these amazing historic spots in it. So the men's race, this is always a funny way that the organizers put this kind of route guide together. They tell you how many cobbled sections there are and how many climbs there are, but of course, a bunch of the climbs are cobbled. So it's a little strange that they do it this way. But the men have 6 cobbled sectors, and they have 19 climbs. Again, a bunch of those climbs are cobbled, so there's a lot of cobbles to go over. And then the women will have 5 cobbled sectors and 13 climbs. Both races are going to be ending with that sort of now classic. It's not new anymore. Out of Clermont and then Paterberg double. That's, I think, you have to assume where most of the action's going to be happening at the front, although as we've seen, a lot of attacks flying pretty far out in the classics this year. But yeah, the Clermont-Paterberg double, I think, is the real highlight of the race towards the end there. And yeah, men's side, I don't think I'm really breaking any news here by saying it's all about Wout van Aert, Jumbo-Visma versus Mathieu van der Poel, possibly versus Tadej Pogacar. I think with the bookies as of Wednesday, because I care about these things, not that I bet, I just like to know what they think because they make money off it, so they're probably pretty good at it. Mathieu van der Poel is your favorite by a little bit. I personally tend to think that Wout van Aert and his Jumbo-Visma team are pretty darn strong, though. And then Tadej Pogačar is kind of a wild card. I don't think people really know what to expect from Pogačar at this race because he is such a wild card. He's probably not going to win a sprint among Van Aert and Van Der Poel, but he's a pretty good bike racer. He's won some things. So I'm expecting a pretty aggressive finale from all those guys with Jumbo-Visma having multiple cards to play. And who knows, maybe Quickstep will get involved in this race that they've won a few times before. But maybe not. I don't know.
I have a hot course take that was this actually came out of Omloop earlier this year. So Omloop Nieuwsblad is essentially run on the old Flanders finale. And when that Flanders finale was swapped from the old Flanders finale, which is the Muir and the Bosberg and then into the finish, to the new one, which is those loops on the Cormont-Paterberg, there was just a massive hullabaloo. I think this is probably like, well, it's before your time, Johnny and Kate, but you see, it was a whole thing. It was like a 3 months of yelling, not even, it was a year of yelling about the Muir not being, in its iconic spot on the course and all these other things. And anyway, it's been, 6-7 years now, I think, since that happened. And I would like to put my hand up and say the new version is better. That's my hot.
What do the cranks say? What's the view of the cranks?
Do I even have to tell you, Johnny? You can guess exactly what the cranks say. The cranks want Muir Bosberg into the finish. And I genuinely, after watching Omloop this year, and I was reminded of the fact that, one, it's often a headwind into the Bosberg and over the top. And two, the Bosberg is not really enough to like split anything up near the end. Not like the Paterberg and the Quedamont are. That the new one is better. The new one gives us smaller groups and sort of more chaos in the final 50K than the old one did. And that is my hot course take. That's not a preview. It's just my hot take.
I know that the cranks were not happy about it at first. I do wonder what they think now. I mean, we've had enough really good additions lately that maybe some of them have come around. Maybe. Yeah.
Would they prefer someone to not gift a win on the new course or someone to gift a win on the old course? That's the real question.
We'll have to ask them.
Yeah,
you know what, Johnny? You and I will. I guarantee you, we will see Tom Boonen or Eddy Merckx at some point in the next 10 days, and we'll try to get close enough to them to ask. Boonen will answer almost any question you put in front of him. I think he's trained from 15 years of being a pro bike racer that if a question happens in his vicinity, he actually has to answer it. And I've never had.
No, I wish they trained them that way now.
Right. Tom Boonen is also like just one of the nicest guys that I think I've ever interviewed in the pro peloton.
Is he?
Like just a generally, he's just like a nice human being to press, I should say, like in that particular situation. I don't know him in any other situations. Cocaine, etc.
No, don't be mean. You just said he was nice. I know a lot of nice people who did cocaine. I went to art school.
He's super nice. Like he's just really amicable. He's just a chatty, like really charismatic guy. But he does. He if you just chuck a question at him, he doesn't have to know who you are. He doesn't have to recognize you. He doesn't have to know you're a reporter. He'll just answer it. And so I think we have to try to go for that sometime in the next 10 days.
Tom Boonen, do you want a statue of your legs made? Yes. Okay.
Yes, exactly. That's how that works. 100%. Will you go stand next to it and make all sorts of funny faces? And yeah, absolutely. 100%. Sorry, I just derailed that again. Dane, you ran through the sort of I guess the hot favorites for this thing. Is there anybody we should be keeping an eye on who you haven't mentioned yet? Sort of dark horse. Who's up there?
That's a great question. I guess the entire Movistar team, that's what we've learned over the past few weeks, is one answer to that question. Other answer to that question is a little bit hard. I mean, I think there's a bunch of riders kind of bubbling under the surface of that big three. I'm not really, there's nobody where I'm thinking, I have this hot tip that's going to win the race. I don't really feel that way about this race. I think if it's not one of those three, it's still somebody good. It's maybe somebody on Quickstep. Maybe they actually get it together. It's maybe... You know, Trek's got a great team with Mats Pedersen and Jasper Stuyven. Ineos has been pretty good at classics lately, even if we were just trashing on their Grand Tour aspirations. I think if there's a sort of a secondary or tertiary rider, it's one of those kinds of guys. But I don't know that you can just be a 20-year-old prospect out of nowhere and go win the Tour of Flanders. It's a really hard race to do that in. And yeah, I don't really see that happening.
Is there any chance of the three riding themselves out of the race? Because Laporte, after winning this morning, was basically like, they asked him, like, all right, well, you know, are you a Flanders contender now? And he's like, ah, the other three are on a different level. Like, there's three others that are on a different level, right? Roughly translated, because he was chatting in French. And I think that's generally true. But so the only way that one of those three doesn't win is if they do kind of ride themselves out of the race. Is that a feasible thing? Or
I think it's feasible. It's certainly feasible that they're all three riding together and somebody's handlebar catches a jacket on the barriers. That has happened before with groups of big threes. So that could always happen. I'd be kind of surprised if all three of them managed to ride themselves out of the race, though. I mean, that's going to be hard.
One thing I could see happening, and this is based off of, well, kind of what Pogaccia did last time. I could see something like Wout and Vanderpool getting off the front, Pogaccia not being in the right position and therefore missing the move and basically pulling it all back together by himself so that we end up with a much larger group than we would have otherwise into the finish. That's the way that I could see them. When I say riding themselves out of the race, I don't mean like crashing into a hedge individually three different times. I mean like the tactical dynamics between those three essentially resulting in like what would probably, the way that it would probably play out would be a larger group at the finish line and then some other better sprinter taking
that certainly seems plausible to me.
That feels semi-plausible to me, but I think realistically it's such a hard day that as long as Vanderpool and Van Aert and Pogacar pick their moment well and pick a moment when it's really hard, who's going to follow them? No one's going to follow them, and then they have proven already that they will work together, right? So I it's hard to look past those three. It really is. It's not impossible to look past those three, but it is difficult. Before we move on to the women's race, Kate, you got to run. You got to go do an interview. So thank you for joining, and I'll catch you at Roubaix, where you're going to be with us next week. Yay. All right. See you next week. Bye, Kate.
Ciao. Bye.
All right, Dane. On to the women's race. Let's chat favorites here. I think that the last couple of weeks have made that relatively clear. I think SD Works is once again hard to look past, but who specifically are we looking at?
Yeah, so I think one interesting point about SD Works, so this is just something that they've done year after year after year. To me, the dominance that they've shown this year is more complete than we've seen in a while. And that's saying a lot about this team. But you know, during its Bols Dolmans years, it was a pretty dominant squad. But the depth that they have, the way that Vollering can win races, Wiebes, Capecchi, and Marlon Reusser, apparently, that's a lot of firepower to overcome. And so when you look at the roster for Flanders, to me, it does really seem like it's SD Works versus the world. And I have a hard time imagining that the world is going to be able to contain them. It's you know, Capecchi and Vollering, both really, really strong options there. We've already seen them together shining this year. If you're looking outside of that team, obviously Annemiek van Vleuten is an option. And yeah, Mara Navas has been a pretty good bike racer in her career, so she might do something. I think those are your two big hopes to take on this team. And then
she was super active this morning at Dwarves.
She was.
Voss was. Yeah. Which is a great sign.
Yep, I think with the trying to beat SD Works conversation, I kind of think there's a little bit of luck involved. I think it kind of comes down to you need to pick the right move to follow because they have the ability to send multiple riders off the front. They do a really good job of leveraging all their talents. I mean, we've seen a lot of teams that have had multiple talents not leverage them very well before. I mean, I can think of so many Movistar examples from the men's side where they should be firing off multiple attacks and, you know, working together to kind of wear down. And instead, they just attack each other. And that's not, you know, the SD Works team has done a really nice job of that, of kind of leveraging all those options. And I think it might take a little bit of luck. You might have to go with the right move and then maybe outsprint somebody in the final because you're probably not going to get away from them. They're not going to they're not going to let you get away. Even if you're a really, really strong rider, I have a hard time imagining that Marianne Vos can just go off the front and not get followed. Maybe Van Vleuten, but she hasn't seemed as strong lately. So it really does seem like the SD Works show. We should say that the Trek team has had some injuries and illness. That's, I think, damaged their chances a little bit because they might be up there in that conversation were it not for that. But yeah, we'll have to see if anybody can take on SD Works yet again.
Yeah, medium-sized group again feels like probably the best way to defeat them. And then you lean on somebody like Balsamo or something like that. But oof. Yeah, it's hard to look past them when they just send riders off until nobody chases them, and then again, this is, I think, somewhat a function of like the way that the women's peloton operates right now. You end up with these sort of chase group, the G2, right, of just leaders, and then no one chases, and then
right,
they're gone. And that's exactly what's happened the last couple of weekends. It's what happened this morning. It's you have to think that that's probably the way that one plays out too. No. Nonetheless, it'll be exciting up until the point where we find out who goes, basically. And then my guess is there's not a whole lot of chasing happening behind. So let's cut it off there. We're going to have a lot more coming at you from Belgium and Northern France in the next week. We're going to have some special episodes. We're going to have a bunch of live stuff. If you are a member, we're going to have some live Discord chats and during some of the races and throughout the week. If you're not a member, again, shame upon your house, and please go sign up. That would be very much appreciated. I should say I'm like partially kidding. I understand that we're asking a fair amount of money to support Bicycle Media, and so if it's not in your budget, it's not in your budget, but we genuinely hugely appreciate every single one of you that signs up. It's going to keep us alive, and it's going to keep this whole thing going. So, all right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Dane. Kate's gone, but thank you to Kate. We'll be back from Belgium this weekend. Bye-bye.
See ya.